Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the number one fintech radio show and podcast globally with 7 million listeners in 178 countries. This week, we traveled all the way to Paris, France to attend the Paris Fintech Forum. You're going to hear from a bunch of our old pals at the Paris Fintech Forum this week, including Currency Cloud, Tandem Bank, Zopa, eToro, and others. So you will hear from that in a moment. But before that, we went down to Oz, to Sydney, to a new team working on relationship lending there, a team called Credi. And we heard about what they're doing in terms of lending as a software service. At Breaking Banks this week, we caught up with the team down in Oz. They're not battling the bushfires, or they might be existentially, but they're working on making loans quick, easy, and affordable between friends and family. And this is CEO Tim Kadeen of Credi. We'll just call him Tim. What does the K stand for, Tim?
It stands for Kendrick. How weird is that?
Kendrick. Sounds very, very formal.
Well, it caused a lot of amusement at school for a long number of years.
And I believe you're coming to us from Western Australia, Fremantle.
I am. I do split my time between the West Coast, and we have an office in Sydney. So there's a lot of travel involved for most Aussies who are dealing interstate. And actually, as our business is now reaching into the US and Europe, it's travel all the time. I think Qantas told me last week that I'd done something like 34 flights in the last 12 months. So I'm definitely a friend of the national airline.
If you want to compare travel stats anytime, I'll take you on.
Easy. Yeah.
No. Okay. So I want to figure out, you know, what is relationship lending, and where does, you know, in typical sort of fintech terms, you know, what's the technology play here?
Okay, so relationship lending is a kind of old bank term, if you Google it, that sort of denoted lending to people they have a relationship, which is kind of a bit weird for me, given that most lending decisions are automated and there's very little relationship in it at all. So relationship lending in the sort of the more modern context is where people are financially transacting people with that they know. Degrees of trust, close people, children, not quite so close, people who are maybe overseas or in different jurisdictions. So the technology play here is to provide a platform that recognizes the transaction and actually gives individuals lending to individuals or businesses exactly the same toolkit that a bank would use, you know, all the way through from documentation to repayment automation and even through the imminent guise of open banking and visibility in the general credit environment. So it's kind of intersecting those two worlds and bringing informal lending up into the new decade.
Now, this is really how lending started and banking started, to be honest, right? Banking was community-based. It started with people in the community supporting others and things like that. So, and insurance also, right? I guess so sort of we're getting back to our roots.
Yeah, we are. I mean, a lot of people ask me how big is the marketplace? And look, it's always been huge. It's received a lot of sort of public parlance, you know, the so-called bank of mum and dad. I read an article in the press yet this morning that's saying, you know, with the property uptick in Australia, you know, the bank of mum and dad is, you know, in full flight again. But it's always really been there. I think the issue more is that individuals in a whole load of areas are doing their own thing. I mean, you see it in property through Airbnb, you see it in vehicles through Uber, and now people are wanting to be self-determinant with their money. And obviously, with that comes friction, and therefore a platform is needed. So it's as old as the hills, and you know, it will endure for a long time to go.
Now, you know, we've seen a lot of use of peer-to-peer. Obviously, started with Grameen Bank on the financial inclusion side on the subcontinent, but more recently, of course, you know, we have some pretty big peer-to-peer lending organizations, Lending Club, which IPO'd. We've got Prosper, we've got Zopa in the UK. You know, we've seen others enter this market more recently. You know, Funding Circle, Lending Tree, Kiva, and others. Is there, you know, with relationship lending, it seems an obvious target for more social types of lending structures. Is social media an important part of Credi's foundation for establishing these relationship loans?
Okay, so it's an interesting one, actually, because I think peer-to-peer, in terms of the companies you've mentioned, has kind of hijacked a term that kind of easily describes what they do, whereas, in fact, you know, the basis of the financial decision in those environments are really through people who don't actually know each other. And in fact, they carry the same kind of default rates as traditional banking, and they use the same kind of, as I said, credit decisioning. You know, and that sort of leads to a point where the different marketplace, which is the pure or true peer-to-peer relationship, is where people have a relationship between people that they know. And you know, on our platform, which has, you know, thousands of users, that's exactly what we see. People come to us because they've identified a need to either help someone or be helped by somebody. And they've usually got that that relationship already in mind. And in fact, there's some regulatory characteristics that we play off, in the sense that, you know, we're not an organization that needs a huge regulatory footprint across the, you know, multiple jurisdictions, because the people are not performing a credit activity which would be described if you were sort of marketing through those kind of platforms.
So it's more informal credit.
Yeah, it is informal credit that we are, I guess, formal.
You're an informal credit that you're formalizing.
Absolutely.
Through your structure, yeah.
Yeah, look, it's all about taking the friction out. And I think, you know, it's an interesting story for me, because, you know, back in my sort of past, I happened across Australia's first peer-to-peer lending platform that predated people like Society One and RateSetter. It's a small little company called iGrin, and it got like $1 million on the market and a few thousand users. I actually bought it. In fact, I still own it. I own the code and the sort of the IP to it, but I never relaunched it, because, you know, I saw that those platforms really get to a point where they're struggling to find, you know, enough customers, they're struggling to make money. And I thought, you know, my journey to creating the Credi product, I had to go underneath that. And that's where I landed, which was, you know, managing the transactions between, you know, people like us, between you and your friends and family and businesses, you know, businesses that you invest in, et cetera, where the key to the transaction is the relationship, not a traditional credit scoring decision that underpins the infrastructure.
So what you do is you take independent parties that may be one-to-one or it may be many-to-one, where either someone says or a group of people say, we are going to lend money to this individual for this purpose, and we need a platform to help us execute that. Is that a good description of Credi?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, the alternative before Credi arrived was a loan document, right? You get a piece of paper. And comparing a loan document to Credi is like using a map to navigate your way up and down the country versus Google Maps. You know, a loan is something that, you know, has a beginning, it has a negotiation, it has an establishment, it's e-signed, contract is completed. It then has a repayment cycle. It then is tweaked and changed. Repayments are made, they're forgiven. Overpayments, underpayments, late payments, early payments. Loans are renegotiated. So the platform effectively does all of that and has the sort of Google Maps sort of utility and flexibility versus, you know, the historic, I'll send you something and we'll sign it, which is kind of out of date the minute it's been signed and doesn't reflect the changing circumstances.
That's good progress. So tell me a bit about the foundation story behind Credi. How did you guys get started? There's an obvious alignment in terms of your wish to sort of assist people and seeing something that's informal that could be easily structured through tech. But tell me a bit more about how it came to be, the company.
Okay, yes. I had a sort of a background, all the way through from economics to accountancy through to accounting software companies, Sage in the UK. And I happened across, and I was invited to recruit to join a US corporation about 10 years ago, which was in microlending, which is so-called, now known as payday lending. I didn't know it at the time. And, we were involved in about 150,000 microtransactions a month, like big scale operation. I got...
What was the size of the loans, typical size?
$500 over like 30 days. Right. And, that was back in the day where there were very few operators. The default rate was single digit percentages, where it's now 34% default rate in that kind of sector. And the government has almost run those operations out of town. But what I got from that is a very clear understanding of the damage of high-cost credit. And I was able, having sort of exited from that position, to look and investigate the market of the other side of the fence, which is effectively, well, how can credit be delivered, which is benign, which is friendly? And, as I happened, forced by my 27-year-old to open my own branch of the bank of mum and dad. And, I always knew from the phone call, how much money he wanted. Hey, dad, long pause. God, he needs a lot of money. Short pause, not quite. And it's always the same, right? And so, of course.
Dad, I've really missed you. Oh, boy, this is going to be expensive.
Honestly, it was always like that, right? So I looked around and... I thought, look, I'm a tech guy. I've worked in tech. I can figure for this out. And there's nothing. And still there's nothing that does that, right? So I applied a bit of science. I went off to RMIT and I said, look, can you do a study for us? And this was the liftoff moment. Got a report back and it said, lending, RMIT, lending between friends and family, an invisible phenomena. And I went, well, that's it. So we went and built the platform. And, so it's a bit like, Saul on the road to Damascus. I kind of went from an environment where the APR was like 300% to an environment where the APR is about 3%. So there's a real... a real complete 180 in terms of the credit environment that I was working in. And it's not only been a pleasure, it's been a great success.
Tell me how people set up a loan on the credit platform today.
It can take seconds to a few minutes. It's as simple as we built it almost along the lines of what do you want to do? Like designing a car, really. Log on to the platform, sign in, get an account, and then you go ahead and build a loan. You can build it as a borrower or as a lender. What do I want? How much money do I want to offer? Let's take it from that side. What interest rate am I able to pay? How long do I want it? When do I want to loan at the start? I mean, in the banking environment, it's all linear. This is flexible. I want the money today, but I want to start repaying it in 6 months' time. I want to pay a token. I want a balloon repayment at the end. And then it's sent to the counterparty who you know, and that person receives it, and they can negotiate it. And that's the starting point of the way that we're offering a sort of socially acceptable product. Because, the person on the receiving end can say, hey, click, look, I can't help you. It's not appropriate now. Whereas historically, loans for under $2,000 are free and always have been and kind of always will be, which is a kind of nod to the payday space. But, it's a counter to the chat down the pub where you go down the pub and you had a couple of beers and then, at the end of a few beers, you get the money chat. So this is going to help me. Well, it takes that away.
So let's say I come on credit.com and I set up a loan to lend my son some money to buy a car. Mm. I contribute some, but I say to him, well, I want you to learn how to pay back a loan and I'm going to lend you this money. And but I'll pay for half the car. You pay for the other half, but I'll loan you the money to buy it and you can pay it off. So that's a fairly typical scenario. But in the instance where you lend money to maybe someone that you don't know as well, but the loan gets into trouble, How do you guys handle that platform?
Okay,
so how do you handle that issue?
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting points there. Firstly, when we started the business, like everything else, I built it for me. And what I realized down the track is that there's a number of layers of trust. And what you're alluding to is the fact that people may want to sort of put more hooks, for want of a better word, on it. So through the process, I mean, you can do such things as, for a car, for example, in Australia, you can take a secure charge over the asset. So you can put some security interest registration on it if you wish. Also, and this is where technology, all the sort of kind of moons are lining up. The move towards open banking has presented us with a very interesting sort of endpoint, and that is the simple process of setting up the loan, managing the repayments, processing the repayments through the banking system has actually put the credit transaction, credit loan reference 1234, bang in this sort of under the microscope of other credit providers. So we're getting to the point that not only are we establishing a loan and automating the repayments, but we're actually making credit visibility to mainstream credit. So, you know, when a bank looks at the transaction statement and goes, look, I'm looking to lend you money for your house. Ah, I see you've got a loan there that's a relationship loan. Tell me about that.
That's pretty.
And
that's cool.
The government has actually gone on record through ASIC in Australia, and they've actually said more recently that we want you to look at someone's entire financial circumstances. So the open banking movement that is trundling across the world has kind of presented us with a sort of an unprecedented closing of the sort of the circle. We now are able to intersect for the first time the world of informal and I allude back to RMIT here, invisible transactions, and we're able to actually overlay them and intersect them with traditional credit providers, which means that, you know, if you're lending to someone, say a cousin of yours that's, you know, in another part of the country or the world, then they might want to borrow from you, but they've also got to be aware or will be aware that there's some hooks. Now, of course, to your original question, of course, you now have a contract, you've now got repayments that have been structured, you can have got evidence of the repayments, you've got all the necessary details that if it does go bad, you've got a pre-packed solution to pursue all the normal remedies that are available to you in law to collect against that.
Okay, now that answers, but you guys don't handle collections and stuff like that internally.
We're software as a service.
You just facilitate, yeah.
We facilitate right the way through from inception through to visibility. Now, you know, there's a sort of an endpoint that may drop off from that, because what we're now starting to develop is sort of the concept of neo credit scores. So, you know, to some extent, we've got some conversations with traditional credit providers where they're saying, look, we're going to turn someone down for a loan here, but we're going to ask them to perhaps go and figure it out themselves. And we'll use the performance of the credit managed loan for a future credit decision. So if you've shown that you can manage a loan from your dad, that'll count in your favor when you come back to us in the future. So the smart sort of fintechs around the world and the smart neobanks around the world are actually starting to wake up that a binary decision, can I lend you or can I not lend you, actually has a third one. I can't lend to you just now.
Let me give you an alternative and develop a lending history and we can do something.
That's using a very weird a word back into the banking system. I think it's called trust.
Yeah, I mean this, you know, we've seen various startups attempt similar things, you know, structured lending and so forth that enables you to build a credit score over time and so forth, which I think is great. But these, let's talk a little bit about sort of these neo credit scores. You know, what do you see emerging behaviorally or from a non-traditional scoring metrics that would represent something like that?
Yeah, look. Traditionally, credit scoring has been exercised through the credit reference agencies, who I think are in danger of having their existing platforms being rendered obsolete. Certainly, in the micro lending world, no one even reports to the CRAs, and they are using almost universally.
When you say CRA, a credit reference association, or
credit reference agencies. Vida, Experian, Dun & Bradstreet, Tran, etc. So the fintech world and increasing the banks are actually using bank statement categorization. So that's where they're reading into the platforms.
So it's sort of mainly cash flow and analytics. So looking at your accounts, looking at have you got more money going in than going out, and does that reflect an element of control over your spending that would support a credit line, right?
100%. And so our job in terms of the informal lending space is to provide information to that. Now, that's one side of the intersection point. For our part, our objective is to develop scoring within our own platform. Yeah, very much in the early days, it'll be alongside like a rating system, 5-star rating, 4-star rating, 3-star rating, whatever, so that the performance of your loan within the credit platform can actually be viewed if someone wants to lend money to you again. Because we've been only been going 4 years, but we're already seeing people come back with second and third transactions, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a bit early for us to actually generate our own performance scoring, but certainly it'll happen. In the short term, for us, contributing our performance data to traditional banks, credit providers, to enable them to assess the performance for their own decision will be where we start.
Now, you guys right now are a software as a service platform that enables people to come together. You're not actually a financial institution, are you?
No, absolutely not. We work very hard not to be. We're growing.
Could you see a time ever when credit offers to sort of pitch in with the lending, maybe, half and half?
Yeah, look, I mean, we've got a roadmap that's as long as your arm. I think it's got about 168 pieces in it. And at the moment, as I said, we're focusing on open banking and a global rollout, going through rounds of funding.
So talk about your rollout. Where are you currently? Where do you operate? How many languages are you available in?
Okay, so we've got users in 26 countries. That came through from opening the platform out. And we are now rolling out language versions to cover French, German, Spanish, variations of Spanish, Portuguese, Polish. The rollouts to other countries, we're picking the main markets, which is US, we have Credit Inc. Set up, UK and Europe, particularly for both open banking. We're getting a number of approaches for JVs in countries, Nordic states, Indonesia, where kind of it's this sort of local market knowledge is saying, look, this platform will apply to Sharia law lending. So we see that our rollout is one, I suppose, our own ambitions around the world, driven by taking.
But the contract law that underpins this arrangement, if you want to call it that, would vary country by country.
Absolutely will vary by country. So, in Australia, and there's some nuances, we have something like a Div 7A in Australia, which covers lending to between individuals and their company, and then you have 401s in the States. So there'll be local country variations. We've just hired an internal legal counsel to help that through. And we've also got a tie-in with an international, one of the top five international law firms to help us with our rollouts in this country. So to some extent, our sort of journey is increasingly going to sort of formalize, as I said, as we go through the funding rounds. But as I say, it has to some extent been driven by both opportunity and people wanting to take us into those territories.
Good. Great. Well, what do you got planned for 2020? Specific
plan for 2020 is really clear. As I said, the open banking integration and moving the money to give us that footprint on the bank statement to give credit visibility is critical. We want to work with remitters so that we can handle cross-border transactions, because a lot of the money moved around the world is repaying family loans as people globalize. Get our footprint in the UK and in the US. Go through funding rounds and seek strategic relationships that then start taking us into other organizations' client bases, either on a collaborative basis, et cetera, et cetera. And then as we go through the end of 2020, we'll look at things such as crypto. We'll look at how we can tokenize the transaction when the token can replace fiat currencies. That'll be something that takes on board.
You're going to lend in crypto? I guess or you're going to enable people to lend crypto to each other?
Yeah, I mean, you know, give me five Libras
Interesting.
And it ticks back. I mean, it's a logical extension that will happen
it
at
is.
The moment. Cross-border transactions are kind of, there still is the exchange rate conversation. And, you know, people don't stop lending money to their friends and family just because they live the other part of the world.
Absolutely.
And that gives even more reason to have a system of record, you know, a universal point of truth that just takes the friction away and lets them get on with their relationship when they can support each other financially without, you know, that getting in the way.
Great, Tim. Well, thanks for joining us all the way from Australia. I trust you got no family involved in the fires there, and everyone's safe.
We're all safe, and Western Australia
has not been as affected. Yeah,
not been affected, and it's been a huge thing for Australia, and I don't think the scale of this
huge thing for the world. Yeah. I don't know whether you guys realize how. Much of a topic has been talked about offshore, particularly in terms of the government's position on climate. So it'll be interesting to see. We won't get into that now because we've run out of time, but that's for another show. Where can people find Credi quickly, Tim?
Easy, credi.com. You can find us on the net. And as we said through the...
What's your Twitter? You got a Twitter handle for the company?
I think it's just Credi. You'll find us on Twitter, and as we said, you know, try it. It's free for loans under $2,000, and we have a lot of people just giving it a go, and that's the best way to see what you think about it.
Great, thank you very much, and thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brad.
With the Wealthfront Cash Account, you earn more interest on your money. They have one of the highest interest rates in the market at 1.78% annual percentage yield. That's 19 times more interest than the national average of 0.09%, according to FDIC.gov. It's easy and fast to get started. It only takes a dollar and a few minutes to open an account, and you can even do it right from your phone, no paperwork required. There are no fees, and your money is FDIC insured up to $1 million through their partner banks. Wealthfront's clients trust them with over $22 billion, and those clients have earned over $70 million in interest through their Wealthfront cash accounts. Wealthfront is the ideal way to manage your money. You can save, plan, invest, and get financial advice all in one place, and they make your money work harder for you. Right now, you can sign up for the Wealthfront cash account in less than 5 minutes by going to wealthfront.com/fintech. Go to wealthfront.com/fintech and start earning 19 times more interest on all your savings. That's wealthfront.com/fintech. Wealthfront is not a bank. Cash account is offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. Wealthfront conveys funds to partner banks who accept and maintain deposits, provide the interest rate, and provide FDIC insurance. The APY is subject to change.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Let's talk about finding freelance talent for your business or project. Finding the right freelancer can be time-consuming, frustrating, and expensive. Where do you go? How much does it cost? How can you be certain they'll deliver? Well, thanks to our newest sponsor, Fiverr, finding the right freelancer is no longer a struggle. Now, we've used Fiverr recently to do artwork and design for our Breaking Banks Europe launch, including a new logo that we designed. It was a quick turnaround, great pricing, and we were able to check the work that the freelancer had done before. So you can go to the Fiverr marketplace. You can look through hundreds of digital services that these freelancers offer, including graphic design, copywriting, web coding, film editing. You can search by service, deadline, price, reviews, and more. Take five and check out Fiverr.com, and you'll receive 10% off your first order by using our code BREAKING. It's so easy. Don't waste any more time and get the service you deserve by going to FIVERR.com, code BREAKING. That's BREAKING. Fiverr, it starts here.
I'm here with Laurent Nisri, and he is the founder of the Paris FinTech Forum. Laurent, tell us a bit about the stats for PFF this year. How long have you been doing it? How many people are here? How many companies?
So 5 years, fifth edition. 11 months to prepare that one, 2,700 unique attendees from 75 countries, 300 plus CEOs and chairs only on stage, from banks, regulators, fintechs, from all over the world. What to say? Just huge success thanks to the huge community, because you are all helping us.
Yes. Now, what's the most exciting thing after 11 months when you come here and it's all set up? For you, what's the most satisfying element of the show?
The real answer will be silly, so I won't say it, but the most satisfying answer would be seeing all those people coming from all over the world to meet together. In fact, what is a bit frustrating is that we have astonishing panel on stages with astonishing panelists, CEOs of all the companies, but in fact, people love it. But do you know what they prefer?
Network.
Meet and network. The floor is so busy you cannot walk. The meeting lounge, nobody can even pack more, because they just need to work together. They want to meet. They want to exchange with each other. They want to see how they can work together, how they can create new businesses. And as we have 65% of our attendees are CEO, C-level, and directors, you have the decision makers. We have all what is needed, and not only for, you know, payment, like so many events, only payment or whatever. We have all this industry. Payment, lending, blockchain. You take whatever event in the world of one in this vertical, we have more CEOs and leaders and disruptors of that vertical here than they have. And so they are all in the same place.
Is that different from the first couple of years when you ran the forum? Has the networking become more critical, do you think, to the success of the forum?
Yes. My way of measuring it is 3 years in a row we have the same number of people in the attendance, because we are sold out every time. The venue is the same. And you can see that the balance between people being in the conference room and networking places has shifted. Before, all the room were full just to see a CEO of a bank speaking with a CEO of a fintech. Today, they are used to it. They come, of course. The room are, of course, good attendance, but not full, because people stay on the ground to network.
Yeah. Okay.
So we see they want it. They want, more than ever in the digital world, work together.
And so where does Paris FinTech Forum go from here?
You have to wait a bit for that. And I hope we'll do a good show together about the future. But let's say that I can give you the teaser, which is to run that event, I do a bit like you, my friend. I go in all the other events in the world. So this year I did 30 to 40, and I think I was bored 30 to 40 times. And as I think that there is absolutely no reason for me to not do the same in a few years, and as doing an event like that takes so much time, I need to say, okay, let's do perhaps a pause, think with the industry, with the people making things changing, the people we have on our stage, the people who come to our event, the sponsor, everybody, and say, okay, you love it, we know it, because we are sold out for everything. I mean, we don't have any more partnerships since August, and we are sold out for tickets. Everybody comes today to buy tickets we don't have. So that's working fine, but I, as a strategy guy, I can tell you that's exactly when you should change. Yeah. If you wait for being dying to change, it's too late, you die. So we are in good health, to be perhaps too good. What I want is think with industry, think with the good people, and build Paris FinTech Forum V2. And perhaps would be another city, another country, perhaps not the name Paris in it, perhaps a new concept, perhaps new dates. We'll see. Everything is open. We are already working on it, as you can imagine. One thing is just for sure, we'll be back.
Lauren Nisri, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thank you very much.
So I ran into Mike Levin, the CEO of Currency Cloud, and you guys have just done an $80 million power round with some pretty amazing players. So tell us about, first of all, tell us about the round, and then what are you going to do with all that cash, dude?
So the round is all strategic investors led by Visa, Bank Paribas, the World Bank, IFC, who really use us for emerging markets, Siam Commercial Bank, so Thai Bank.
Oh, they're great.
They're a great investor, yeah. And SBI, which is SoftBank Internet, is Japanese. So there's
Kitansan,
XE, and Nissan.
Yeah, Nissan.
So Asian investors, European strategic investors, global strategic investors, and of course Visa on top of it.
Right.
And so anyways, the intent of the round is, as you can see from the global investors, to really encourage our global expansion. So the round took a long time to put together because it's all strategics, and they have a long decision process, and we put that together. What do we plan to do with the money? We plan to expand the business in Asia, which it's Asia. Everybody says it's the next growth market, and it is. But also much more important for us in some ways right now is North America.
Yeah.
When it comes to the cross-border business, North America is the last untapped market.
Yeah.
The U.S. is generations behind,
yes,
in terms of what it does, and we're going to invest fairly heavily in bringing our product to market there.
Isn't it ironic? We see stuff like Alipay and WeChat Pay in China going off, and we see the success of your business, of TransferWise and others, but the U.S. has been obstinately slow to adapt to some of these changes, right?
Well, sir, remember, as you have to be regulated to hold the money, you have to be regulated in 50 state markets. So that means that the structure of doing anything in the U.S. is totally different. There are ways to work with that through sponsor banks and infrastructure, but that adds layers of complexity to how you work. So there's a series of institutional issues in the U.S. that make it just harder to be innovative. You've got all the brilliant technology, you've got all the minds, you've got all the cleverness, you've got all that, but you've got a regulatory infrastructure that actually works against being able to get to the scale that you need. So we're getting there, figuring out how to work at it. We do it, so we're getting there. But North America's hard. But the issues that brought us to the whole of the world, pricing, transparency, ease of use, are actually worse in North America than they are anywhere else in the world. So whatever the fintech revolution that's come, it'll come there too.
Yes. Now, are you still basing yourself out of London, or where are you?
I'm in London. I'm a London guy, yeah.
And any plans to, like, you, so where's your offices in New York? I mean, is it in New York, your offices?
So we have a New York office. We have now our headquarters of the company and myself, we're in London. We now actually have a UK office in Cardiff, where we have quite a lot of developers. We've opened in Amsterdam, and we will actually this year have an office in Singapore. So it's a global business. We have global people everywhere. But we're a London-based company.
Well, Mike, great to run into you at the Paris FinTech Forum.
Always good to see you.
Take care.
Take care. Yeah, bye-bye.
Ricky Knox, Tandem. How are you?
Super well. Really great to see you, Brett.
It's been a couple of years since we were in the Paris FinTech Forum taking selfies in the speaker room, and here we are again. So give us an update on Tandem. What are you guys up to, and where's the expansion coming now?
Yeah, so super exciting times at Tandem. We're expanding in Hong Kong, which is going to be our sort of first international reach out. We're also expanding our sort of product range, adding current account, where we've just launched membership for customers who want the sort of full suite of Tandem products. you get 0% credit line. So you're actually you pay your monthly membership fee. You don't have to pay to borrow. You get the highest in market savings rate, and you get a whole load of additional benefits around the outside, including cash back and a number of other bits and pieces.
So are you applying for the new fintech license in Hong Kong? Or are you coming under the Harrods bank acquisition sort of that approach?
That license. So no is the answer to the first thing. So we're currently operating on an e-money license over there, but we do have an intention to apply for a license using our UK entity to apply over there.
And so how did that... Because it's probably been... You know, last time we chatted was around the time you were doing the acquisition. Yeah. So how's that changed the business?
To be honest, it's been great. I mean, changed the business. We always intended to be a bank. We actually sort of had half of a banking license already. The big delta is we have a mortgage portfolio, which I would not have said out of the gate was something we were going to do immediately. Interestingly, there's a reason why banks have mortgages, because it provides a sort of regulatory capital ballast to our higher interest credit cards, which actually makes us way more capital efficient. So odd to say, but now I wouldn't do without it. But it's still not a critical strategic growth area for the bank. It's more a piece of regulatory capital ballast that helps us to manage our ratios efficiently.
So what attracted you to Hong Kong? Your first move out of the UK, why did you choose Hong Kong?
There were a couple of different drivers. I mean, it's interesting because a lot of people were sort of heading towards the U.S. As you know, I'm half American. I've also built a number of businesses in the U.S. I've moved European businesses into the U.S. You know, the U.S. is a brutally hard and competitive market, and I think Europeans massively underestimate it. I mean, the nice thing about Europe is, you know, we're divided by a number of languages, which most people find a sort of insurmountable barrier unless you speak a few of them. And so people think it's incredibly hard to move around in this context, but actually most European countries are uncompetitive in one way or another. And so there is, you know, the idea that we were going to go to the U.S. was definitely not my first move. So we could have gone Europe first, and we will go to Europe. But we felt that testing in a smaller country on our first expansion, when we did Azimo, we did 28 European countries overnight, turned the whole thing on and then figured it out. Having done that once, I think testing, you know, the replication of your systems, what databases are going to be shared, what ones need to be split up for regulatory reasons, figuring all that stuff through, actually in a smaller jurisdiction with a little bit lower investment cost, definitely made sense for us.
Great. Well, good luck in Hong Kong. And have you learned any Cantonese yet?
No. Happy Chinese New Year. I'm going to get it wrong, though.
So it's Gong Hoi Fat Choi.
Gong Hoi Fat Choi.
I'll teach you probably one of the most useful phrases, momentai.
Momentai.
Means no problem.
Momentai, no problem. Okay.
Good luck, Ricky.
Thanks very much. Good to talk to you, Brett.
Giles Andrews, co-founder and board member of Zopa. When did you step aside from sort of the day-to-day?
So I stepped down as CEO in 2016 and was executive chairman for about 18 months and then stepped down from that to a more normal non-exec chairman in sort of late 17 and stepped down as chair completely in early or sort of spring 2019.
Now, of course, you guys were one of the first to do P2P lending on a global basis, but, you know, you're...
The first.
But, of course, now, you know, you're getting into the challenger space as well. So tell me about how Zopa has evolved as an organization in the last few years.
So we made a decision towards the end of 2017 to launch a bank. So we thought we'd leverage our capabilities of both acquiring customers very efficiently digitally, providing them with a brilliant user experience digitally, amazing NPS scores, and really good credit management.
You're just showing off now.
So we thought, well, how can we extend that? And the most obvious product to extend those capabilities into is credit cards. And a credit card as an asset is very hard to finance peer-to-peer. And that led us down a journey that ultimately led us to conclude the most efficient way to finance credit card assets would be by launching a bank. So we then embarked upon a two-year bank authorization process, which came to an end towards the end of last year. So we initially got our license with restriction, and then had those restrictions lifted, and we're now going through a change of control process because we brought in another major new investor, and they need to be approved by the regulator, and that should happen in the coming weeks, if not small number of months, at which point we'll launch the bank, which will be really exciting. So Zopa Bank will not only be a name, but will be a trading entity.
So can you talk a bit more detail about you know, the extent of your lending? Because one of the things that was really exciting at one point is where actually in terms of personal unsecured lending, you sort of, when you got over the 5% of the UK lending market, that was a pretty big hurdle, pretty big milestone. But, you know, where's it grown from there?
So we've lent just over £5 billion in total since we launched, but well over a billion of that in the last 12 months. And we've been the largest digital acquirer of unsecured personal loans in the country for a while now. So by that I mean through the aggregator channels, which dominate non-branch sales. So I think Lloyds still sell a few more personal loans than us with their 20% branch network market share, but digitally acquired we are the clear number one. And that was also part of the thought process of how do we continue to grow, that we can't grow that market share forever. Hence looking at alternative assets like credit cards.
So what's next for Giles in 2020?
Well, I'm quite busy. So I've ended up chairing a number of different businesses, mainly in the fintech space. So I chair a consumer lending business called Creditech in Germany, that trades actually in developing markets outside of Germany. I chair a direct mortgage lender and asset manager in the Netherlands called Dynamic Credit. I chair an SME working capital provider in the UK called Market Finance, and a couple of other things as well. But I've ended up chairing a number of different growth companies, and very pleasingly for me, in different geographies, gets me out of the UK from time to time, which is kind of nice.
Good. Well, great to see your continued success with Zopa and personally, and great to catch up in Paris.
Great to see you, Brett.
So I'm backstage at the Paris FinTech Forum, and I've run into another FinTech legend, my good friend Christophe Langlois. Christophe, how are you?
You're far too kind. I'm very well. And you, Brett?
But we were there in the early days, right? You know, I remember you had one of the first, you had Visible Banking, which was a very early blog. When did you start Visible Banking?
I started it back in 2007, actually, and it became quite well known at the time, and I spent hundreds of hours producing content, and then I went to more the corporate world, and I didn't have as much time to carry on, you know, producing content, and now I'm rebooting it.
And then you did a dance video with your wife at your... I remember that.
Thank you. Yeah, I did the best wedding dance video ever. Search for those keywords on YouTube. But what I'm most fond of is that memory of still having lunch with you on Queensway,
right,
maybe 1 or 2 months before you launched Bank 2.0,
right?
In Bayswater, yeah, which was incredible on many levels. And then the world changed for you.
Absolutely. You know, I remember being with Chris in near Liverpool Station at a Costa Coffee, I think, Chris Skinner this is, debating whether I should call the book Bank 2.0 or Bank 3.0. That would have been July 2009. Actually, you were there for the book launch, weren't you? In
there.
London,
I
right?
Yeah, I remember. Yes.
July 2010.
2010, I think. Yeah. I took a few pictures there, I remember. That was quite special.
Yeah.
Quite intimist, you know, compared to now the type of audience you get. And I saw that firsthand at Rise London, so like last year. It was crazy. And you were a real rock star, like a very professional. After a long day, still managing, you know, to sign and to smile and to share insights with everybody. So... What did you achieve actually in so many, in what, 2010?
10 years.
In like 9-10 years.
Yeah,
incredible, yeah. Congratulations, my friend.
Merci, thank you. Now, you're here, you're documenting some of the Paris FinTech Forum. We're obviously, we've just had the Brexit thing happen. You know, it's in the process. We just see TransferWise walking past and others. But when you come to an event like this, the Paris FinTech Forum, now that you spend most of your time in London, how is a European view of FinTech differ from London?
So
is there much difference?
I've been 18 years in London, indeed. So London is home now. Is there a difference? As far as I'm concerned, I don't think so, not fundamentally. When I interview people here, though, I can feel like there's a tiny bit of difference in terms of maybe the attitude, maybe the perception of the potential, maybe, of course, then the specificities of continental Europe or France, for instance, as a market in terms of regulation. Everything is a bit different in the UK, obviously. But what I feed on, which I love, is still meeting like passionate people, entrepreneurs, and that's pretty much international. I interviewed the CEO of October today. When I interview equally the founder of Zopa, or in the US back in the day in 2007, Prosper or Mint at the time, Aaron Patzer. That's what I love, and that's what I love in fintech. It's that passion, that willingness to truly make a difference, truly change people's behaviors and help people like become better savers and make better lives for themselves. So I think that's universal, just with the French accent on top of it in France, yeah.
Christophe Langlois, good to see you again, my friend.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Brett. Yes, see you very soon.
Ran into Yoni Assi, who is one of the co-founder of eToro. Tell us about what's happening with eToro. You've had a big couple of years, right?
Yeah, so we've grown over 600% over the last couple of years through the crypto rally. Last year was very exciting for us. We launched eToro in the US. We launched commission-free stock trading across UK and Europe, being the first broker to offer commission-free stock trading in 17 different exchanges across UK and Europe, and expanding it now. We've launched eToro X, which is our crypto assets exchange, as well as 17 stable coins that are pegged to 15 currencies from euro, dollar, yen, pound, South African, rand, poli, zloty, gold, and silver, and they're all running on our exchange and our mobile blockchain wallet. So we've had a lot of things in the pipeline that were launched in 2019. We've done a couple of acquisitions to expand our offering from Delta, a crypto portfolio tracker, to Firmo, who became our blockchain labs and set up the issuance platform. We started this year with a blast. So we're seeing the rally in the stock markets doing very well for our customers around the world, despite the small correction that we're seeing right now. Crypto is in a much better place than it was just a year from today. So we were at the sort of middle of crypto winter in Q1 2018. We're starting 2020 with Bitcoin at 9,000 after a 20% rally up. A lot of interest coming back to Bitcoin and to crypto in general. So we're very excited about 2020 with a lot of product launches in the pipeline as well.
Fantastic. And where are you based now?
I'm based in Israel, still in Israel. We have today 850 people in 12 different offices with a lot of great managers in eToro making sure that the world is managed.
Do you talk about AUM or trading volumes or anything like that?
We did in 2018 about $1 trillion in volume, and we have more than $1 billion in assets of clients.
Well, it's great to see you again, Yoni, and all the best with eToro in 2020.
Thank you very much, Brett. Always a pleasure.
As always, if you like the show, the single best thing you can do is give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps spread the word, help new listeners find the show. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, and the Finovate podcast, all on Provoke.fm. That's it for this week, and we'll see you again next week for more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.